It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're going to get to the Alex Jones story in a minute, but right now we're talking about pregnancy. Good news for women who are just done with being pregnant by week 39. The New England Journal of Medicine has published a study that deems it safe to be induced before your due date. What is behind this? Why not let nature take its course? Is this another instance of medicalizing pregnancy? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We want to hear your thoughts on this. Ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Tansey Raju is a board-certified neonatologist and chief of the Pregnancy and Perinatology Branch of the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. They are the people who funded the study that was published in the journal. Dr. Raju, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and thank you for having me.
So this study that was published found that healthy women with otherwise normal pregnancies could decide to induce labor at 39 weeks. And it wouldn't, if they did that, it wouldn't increase their risk of getting a C-section. So for those not familiar with all of pregnancy's nuances, do these findings run contrary to popular beliefs about childbirth?
Before I answer that, maybe I want to give a little preamble.
Okay.
So that your listeners will be on board. Typically, we define term pregnancy as completion of the 37th week of pregnancy.
Okay.
And up to the completion of the 41st week of pregnancy.
41st?
Yeah, 41. Mm-hmm. So 5-week range is considered typically defined as term. But recent data has shown that although that 5 week is considered as term, the risk for the mom is not uniform across those 5 weeks. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone has a delivery occurring at the 38th week, 37th completed, but before 39, that has a higher risk for the baby and the mom compared to 39 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 39 weeks is the least risk for the mom. But then the risk keeps going up as she waits longer and longer.
Hmm.
And that is like a U-shaped curve, okay? The best time seems to be 39th and 40th, between that time period. Okay, very narrow range where the least risk occurs in women. And remember, this study is looking at mothers with lowest risk, single term, the only one baby, and the first-time pregnancy. So it is not necessarily the same thing for everybody. You know, the mother may have other complications for which they may need induction earlier or delivery earlier. So those groups are taken out. Here we are really talking about women who otherwise are perfectly healthy. They reach their 39th week pregnancy, which is, theoretically speaking, the least level of risk at that time. And potentially, if you wait longer, then there is a risk that, you know, increasing number of data have been showing that the risk goes up. Yet, there is a controversy. One group says, as you rightly said, pregnancy is a natural phenomenon. You don't want to medicalize it.
Mm.
So let the nature take course and let mom go into spontaneous onset of labor using her own body hormones, and that should be the right way to do. And the other group says, no, you see, we now know 39th week is the least risk to the mom and the baby. Why not we just induce and, you know, reduce the duration of pregnancy by an additional 2 weeks? So there is a literature on both sides of this so far. But more and more evidence seems to be saying 39th week is safe, but it was not 100% sure. That is why this study was designed with a very large sample size. Almost 6,000 women were enrolled, very thoroughly screened, making sure they don't have any other risk factors, etc., and then randomized into one, half of them would get induced at 39th week, and then the other half will go into spontaneous onset of labor. And as you rightly said, the conclusion was very surprising and very pleasing for the hypothesis that there was no difference in terms of risk for if you induce them at 39th week. Because people were arguing if you induce someone at 39 weeks, there is potentially a higher risk of having cesarean birth.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out induction at 39 weeks reduced the risk of cesarean, reduced the risk of mother's preeclampsia, which is a bad condition, because, you know, it reduced the duration of pregnancy by about 2 weeks.
So what you're saying is that if a pregnant woman goes to past 40 weeks, 41 weeks, whatever, then right. she is at increased risk for a cesarean and preeclampsia?
Well, that is the studies that are showing now. Yeah, our conclusion was very clearly compared to those who were electively induced at 39 weeks were much better off than those who went into spontaneous onset of labor whenever it occurred after, you know, but on their own, there was a higher risk, at least 3% higher risk of getting cesarean and all other complications, you know, and preeclampsia. So, yes. So the bottom line was to show that induction at 39 weeks is not a higher risk than spontaneous onset of labor. And not only that was shown in this study, but also the study showed induction was actually safer for the mother. It reduced the cesarean section rate.
So what happens to people, to women who are induced before 39 weeks?
Oh, that definitely is not a recommendation at all. Right now, about 4 years ago, the definition of the entire term was reclassified. We said one who completes 37 weeks up to 38 weeks is considered as early term, okay? And then 39 to 40 plus, you know, 40 weeks and 6 days is full term.
Mm-hmm.
That is the best, least risk period. 41 and beyond is late term. Now, early term babies are likely to have more complications than full term babies in terms of lung disease, etc. So current recommendation is if there is no medical indication for induction, wait until at least 39 weeks, okay? Although, you know, by definition, you have reached term, but early term is not good. So that's why I said it's like a U-shaped curve, you know. Earlier is not good. 39 and 40 is the best. And then if you wait longer, it's also not very good.
So I can imagine that women who are entering their 39th week just want this pregnancy over with. I know this, actually. Are we going to see a rise of women going to their doctors and saying, we're hitting week 39, let's schedule this, let's induce, and are doctors going to be willing to do that? Doctors are always slow to change from their practices.
Yeah, I think you raise a very good point. All the doctors are expected to read this, not only this paper, but simultaneously there is a practice recommendation by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine. Okay, these are professional organizations. They are the ones who make recommendations. They looked at this paper and studied it very thoroughly and say, the conclusions are very reasonable, and the practitioners are advised to discuss this with the family and provide them all the information and then jointly make a decision as to how you handle. And I would caution, this is not for all women at 39 weeks. It is for women with the least level of risk.
Okay, we are going to come back and talk about that. Who is eligible for this? We're talking with Dr. Tonse Raju. He's a board-certified neonatologist, and he's talking about a new study that says that we can induce at 39 weeks without any extra risk. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. A new study in the New England Journal of Medicine shows that women who induce labor at 39 weeks, which is 1 week before we generally consider our due date to be, these women are not at greater risk for a cesarean section. They do, though, end up staying in labor and delivery for a longer period of time than women who aren't induced. Dr. Tonse Raju is a board-certified neonatologist and chief of pregnancy and perinatology at Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. The Shriver Institute funded this study. Are you a woman who has induced? How did that go? Did you induce at 39 weeks? Did you have your children earlier? Did you not give birth till 41 weeks? How did that go? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Dr. Raju, I do want to go back to what I just said, because I've read this in the literature. I read this in your study, but women who do induce are in for kind of a longer labor period, correct?
That's right, yes, because, you know, the protocol allowed that until how do you declare success, you know, the baby she has to deliver. That's right.
Say that again.
Yes, the women who were induced, the duration of, I had to look at the exact number, yes, they were slightly longer labor period, but they also had less of a cesarean birth.
They had less of a cesarean problem. So this study came out earlier this year. This month, the New England Journal of Medicine published this. What's the significance of getting published by the New England Journal?
Well, New England Journal of Medicine goes through a very rigorous process of reviewing the paper, having experts review without, you know, those experts with no conflicts at all with the authors or anyone who funded the study. And after that, they publish this, and NICHD, our institute, provides evidence. We are not making recommendations. National Institute of Child Health, or NIH, provides the evidence, and then the professional societies take up, and it's a very high-profile journal, and people take it very seriously. So that's the implication of paper in the New England Journal.
And we were talking before the break about doctors actually taking this and making it integrating it into their practice. Are you hearing from doctors? Are they skeptical of this, or are they looking at this and saying, "Yeah, that's what I've been seeing in my practice"?
Well, it is rather too soon for us to hear from the doctors. It is already the professional societies have said that this is a very reasonable conclusion in this paper, and doctors should take it seriously, discuss with the family. And you were asking about, you know, what if a woman requests for induction, what should the doctor do?
Mm-hmm.
My recommendation would be very, very, or my suggestion would be that let the doctors read not only the paper in the journal, but in the journal there is also a supplemental material that is available on the electronically, and that gives the entire protocol that lists all the conditions. If there are those conditions, they should not be induced. You see, this is a very, very low-risk group of women. First-time pregnancy, underline that. First time one is pregnant, not mm-hmm. Multi-para.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's only singleton, only one baby. And there are no problems identified either in the baby or in the mother. No medical condition, no surgical condition. Nothing that would require induction earlier, you know, even before 37 weeks. So such a low-risk women, then it is appropriate to have them induced. That's the conclusion of the study. Or at least, if it is induced, there is no additional risk. There is no increased risk of having cesarean birth, which is likely to occur if you wait longer. That's the conclusion.
So Lisa Kane Lowe, who is with the American College of Nurse Midwives, said in a recent NPR article that she was worried about this idea of inducing being a more medical approach to childbirth. What do you respond to that?
Well, her concerns are right. If someone really does not follow, as this study was designed, exactly that, there may be a risk of inducing an inappropriate sort of, you know, mother, inappropriate or ineligible. The study has a long list of exclusion criteria. And this debate is always there. Should you medicalize childbirth or not? So a large number of women have normal deliveries without a whole lot of expert help. We know that, right? Midwives can deliver them very, very well. At home deliveries take place. But it is a small percentage of women who have a problem, who may have a problem, and that may not be detected beforehand. So the bottom line is, if you screen someone extremely well and make sure that they don't have any medical condition, medical complication, etc., then this approach is not wrong. I mean, it can be done, and her concern is appropriate. Some people may simply say, well, anyone who reaches 39 weeks, I can induce. That is not the conclusion of the study. The conclusion of the study is, in a very low-risk women, induction at 39 weeks did not increase the risk of cesarean birth or any other risk that, in fact, if any, there's some benefit. So that's the conclusion of the study. So her concerns are right, but it needs people to get educated and read not simply the paper, but also all the appendix and supplemental material that are available.
And most of the people that were studying in this were in their 20s. They were seemingly very healthy. As you said, they were having single babies, and this was a first-time pregnancy. Are there any studies that have been done on women who are perhaps in their 30s with a first-time pregnancy? We know that the risk factor is higher there. Can we induce labor earlier there? Maybe they need labor induced. Maybe it is even more risky for them to go 41 weeks?
Yes, your point is well taken. In our study, in the table one shows that majority of half of women in the median age was 24 years. And the range went up to 28, but there were at least 100-plus women, 114 and 136 women, more than 35 years of age. So we did not exclude more than 35 years of age in this study.
Okay.
But there was a study in England, from England, I think, there they did a study in women who were older, but they did not have any other risk factor. And even that showed no additional risk related to induction. And I can also suggest the link to another systematic review, as we call it, which summarizes all the published literature, and a Cochrane review of this approach that has concluded very similar to this paper. And that paper, the review came in May of this year, just a few months before our paper came out here. So that came to the same conclusion that, in fact, induction was even... The effect of 39-week induction in low risk was even much higher, much better than our own paper here. So I would recommend definitely for folks to study this, read it, and then discuss this issue with the family before making any, before just jumping into doing induction, everyone who comes at 39 weeks.
We are taking your calls on this idea that you can induce at 39 weeks without risking a cesarean section. Charlene in La Crosse called in to say this idea of induction at 39 weeks is interesting. She added that she always thought that your body knows best when this needs to be done. That being said, she had her twins at 37 weeks. Congratulations, Charlene. 37 weeks is considered pretty much full term for twins, right, Doctor?
Yes. 37 weeks is considered 37 completed weeks. Absolutely. So then because in the twins, if you wait longer, the risks will increase rather dramatically.
So, right.
Congratulations for her. And
yeah.
So happy to hear everything went well.
We also have Natalie from Shorewood calling in. Natalie, welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
Yes, I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. So I'm 28. I ended up with gestational hypertension, but pretty much from the beginning, my OB decided to induce at 39 weeks.
Mm.
I did end up with a negative experience. My induction was 52 hours and ended in a cesarean.
Wow.
But I actually don't disagree with her original decision, because I feel like the risks would have been greater had I gone longer, and my baby ended up healthy and everything was fine. So I actually really agree with the study, even though I was one of the people that ended up with a bad result.
Well, you ended up with a good result. You ended up with a baby, right?
Right, yes. Well, I mean a bad result in terms of my labor experience.
Okay. And how old is your child now?
He's 3 months. I had him May 13th, Mother's Day.
Bless you, and have fun sleeping. Good luck sleeping.
You've got doing great. He's sleeping through the night.
Yay. Thank you. Doctor, what other, in 30 seconds, what may we take away from this? Should pregnant women be talking to their doctors about this?
Oh, they should be talking about the risk. The lady who just called a minute ago, she had preeclampsia, and therefore her decision was right. And even in this study, even in the induction group, 18% did have cesarean. So it's not as if you prevent all the cesarean if you induce.
We have been talking to Dr. Tonse Raju. He has been talking about a new study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which found that healthy women could induce labor at 39 weeks without risking an increased cesarean section. Dr. Raju, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Alex Jones is not on the internet, at least not in the popular media of Facebook and YouTube, among others. Jones was banned from a number of internet sites for violating their terms of service with hate speech. But Jones did not spring out of nowhere. Just a decade ago, there was Glenn Beck, who then is poised to become the next conspiracy populist. More importantly, what role do these people fill in U.S. society? Do you think iTunes, YouTube, Spotify, or other companies made the right call when they decided to ban Alex Jones from their platforms? Or was Twitter right to let him stay on? In a muted capacity, actually. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guest for this half hour is Michael Sokolow. He is the Associate Professor of Communications and Journalism at the University of Maine. His article in The Conversation is called Audiences Love the Anger. Alex Jones or Someone Like Him will be back. Michael, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So earlier this month, Spotify, Apple, Facebook, and YouTube banned Alex Jones outright. There's some controversy over what Twitter did. Twitter muted him, didn't they?
That's right. They sort of gave him a timeout while they reviewed some of his old tweets. And actually, they were helped by that. A lot of people sent them in and reported old tweets that violated the service. And so he sort of got suspended.
So he's not really on Twitter. So what's your take on all of these companies banning him? Is that the death knell for him?
Well, it's even bigger than the social media companies. He had a home base station in Austin, Texas, that the FCC has since gone after. I don't know if you saw that as a pirate station and some other things. For Alex Jones, the question for me and what I sort of posed in that article is whether Alex Jones is more sort of symbolic of a larger issue in American politics and culture, or if he's sort of sui generis, his own problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of would argue that the kind of conspiracy theories that he traffics in, and he's very extreme, but the kind of theories that he traffics in that are problematic for the American public sphere, they're going to reoccur. And so the kind of questions that Facebook, Spotify, YouTube all have to deal with right now, they have to come up with a better solution because there will be somebody else who will get very popular in a problematic way soon enough.
And are there going to be lawsuits over this? I mean, this strikes me as maybe a free speech issue. Federal law does protect hate speech to a limit. I mean, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater and you can't tell somebody to go kill somebody. But these are private corporations that have decided to ban a user, to ban somebody. Are there going to be legal wranglings over this?
No, really, I very much doubt it because the law is pretty settled on, exactly as you said, what these private platforms can do. And remember, the platforms themselves are indemnified by the Communications Decency Act, so they can't get in trouble for what Jones says on them. So, they Jones doesn't have a leg to stand on to sue, and that's probably why he hasn't launched a lawsuit yet. It would be a real waste of money and time. There's a whole separate question, which we're finding out now through the Parkland shooting survivors, around defamation and liability through these channels. But that's not really the Alex Jones issue. And even he realizes that it's not necessarily a free speech issue, because he's said before in previous cases, a year or two ago, he sided with Facebook and some of its rules. So,
our producers say that Alex Jones was banned for 7 days on Facebook and that he's back. Do we know this for sure?
On Twitter.
On Twitter, that's what I meant, yes.
Right. Yes, and he's back. But we have to be careful. Alex Jones runs an organization called InfoWars. InfoWars is the one that got banned. Jones himself has been back and forth. And banned on YouTube. It was the InfoWars channel. And, again, we're in sort of a gray area. Jones himself could go back on YouTube, and if he doesn't violate the terms of service, InfoWars can't, but Jones himself could. So it's sort of a gray area right now. We're not really sure what's going to happen.
What do you think of Alex Jones, and what do you think of the media companies like YouTube and Facebook and Spotify and iTunes banning him? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Michael Sokolow, you have argued that it really is kind of like whack-a-mole is what I'm hearing here, is that Alex Jones may go away, InfoWars may go away, somebody else will crop up to take his place.
Exactly. And this is the issue, this is a larger cultural issue with conspiracy theories in the United States. One example that just jumps out in the top of my head because I happened to see on Twitter yesterday is, you know, the current president of the United States has tweeted about vaccines and autism and the vaccines and autism link. And, you know, that's the scientific community has disproven that, and there's a, you know, it's very controversial, but that's a conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one level of a conspiracy theory. And you can imagine, or we could even go back to the birther. The president is illegitimate because he doesn't have a birth certificate from the United States. You remember that movie?
Yes.
These are conspiratorial movements that are not healthy for our civic democracy. And yet, I see Alex Jones, I see a spectrum of these kind of issues, and Alex Jones is just way, way out there on the spectrum, but he is related to these same kind of theories.
So what is, Alex Jones was behind the Pizzagate theory, or popularized the Pizzagate incident, right?
Right, but actually, you know who's on Twitter, YouTube, Spotify, and all those places still is Mike Cernovich, the right-wing sort of propagandist, and he's still in all these places. He has since gone through his Twitter feed and removed a whole bunch of this stuff, but they haven't banned him.
Interesting. So what is it about our society now that we really like conspiracy theories? I'm seeing this on the right. I'm seeing this on the left. Constantly having to debunk things when I see them on social media. Why are we drawn to these things?
That's a great question, and there's a wonderful book by Jesse Walker called The United States of Paranoia that really gets into this sort of question of these recurring thematic issues, and one of the reasons is you have to look at what's the current source of insecurity and anxiety in the United States. Does it come from outside? Does it come from inside? Is it economic anxieties? Is it a foreign power? You have to look at these kind of questions to really sort it out and sort it through. So I would ask, you know, your callers and you, what do you think today's biggest source of anxiety is in the United States? And then how does that relate to somebody like Alex Jones?
That's a great question. We have some callers right now on the line. Bernie from Elkhorn, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I wanted to say that I don't follow Alex Jones. I know he's brought up some very important issues that the mainstream media won't touch. But I find it very frightening in a so-called free society that censorship occurs. If you don't agree with the content, that's one thing. But to censor opinion is another. And there's an excellent book by a gentleman named Lance DeHaven Smith called Conspiracy Theory in America. And the term conspiracy theory is used to shut down empirical examination. For example, For several years after 9/11, I considered it ridiculous to consider that there was anything other than what the official government story was. If you go out to Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, you'll see overwhelming scientific evidence that controlled demolitions brought down the Building 7 and the Twin Towers. But there is no mention of this on NPR, WPR, the point of view that conspiracies actually do occur, that are dark elements within our government, is always dismissed as ridiculous.
Okay, Bernie, conspiracy theories about 9/11, Michael, it was a controlled...
I'd like to respond in two ways to that one really quick. I'm not going to touch the 9/11 conspiracy theory. And I will say this. If you're interested in 9/11 conspiracy theories, there's a documentary, I say that with quotes, a documentary in quotes, on YouTube called Loose Change. Watch it all you like. It's fully disseminated, and you can read all about what this caller had just discussed. It's widely discussed. But the first part of what he said is very important, which is conspiracy theories are often too quickly dismissed. And he is correct in that way, and I'll use one example. The abolition of slavery was a conspiracy theory. It began 30 years before the Civil War by a small group of agitators publishing magazines and newspapers that were censored because they were too provocative.
Hmm. So how do we know? I mean, there is such a thing as truth. And when you have people who take something that's not necessarily true, like President Obama wasn't born in the U.S., and disseminating this, how do we guard against those untruths getting out and people believing them?
Well, I would argue that what you just described is really a communicative issue. And once upon a time, we all shared... I wouldn't say that's too much of a fairy tale, but there was a more of a public interchange about what the idea of truth was and how to argue it. What I see is things fragmenting so much on social media that the larger discussion you just described about what is truth and how to get there is sort of evaporating. It's kind of disappearing in today's society.
We are taking your calls on Alex Jones and the nature of free speech. 1-800-642-1234. Amjad from Madison, welcome to the program.
Hello. I found that the previous caller very interesting. I have actually met Alex Jones on three occasions, and I can say with wholeheartedness that is he boisterous and braggadocious and generally a jerk? Yes, that is definitely true. But the First Amendment rights protect him from what he wants to say, just as Antifa, you know, wants to say, hey, let's kill the president or whatever.
Okay. Thank you very much, Amjad. We are talking about Alex Jones being banned from some media companies like Facebook and YouTube. We are taking your calls here. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Alex Jones is being sued by the families of Sandy Hook for defamation, and his main internet outlets, YouTube and Facebook, as well as Spotify, have either muzzled or banned him outright. But won't there be somebody to take his place? Michael Socolow argued that there is absolutely somebody out there. He argued this in The Conversation with a piece titled, Audiences Love the Anger, Alex Jones or Someone Like Him Will Be Back. What do you think U.S. Has, why do you think the U.S. has historical figures just like Alex Jones who spread conspiracy theories? Why are people so drawn to conspiracy theories? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, Michael, we have had an example. We have had examples this morning of people who are drawn to conspiracy theories, but this is not the first time this has happened. Talk to me about Father Coughlin.
Father Coughlin was a famous radio priest, sort of a demagogue. Well, he started out as just a regular religious show on CBS, but he started talking about politics by the early 1930s. First he supported Roosevelt, but then he turned on Roosevelt. And when CBS actually asked to vet his scripts, he refused. He made it his last show on CBS. He made it a big cause, that freedom of speech, and he was eased off, is the wording that was used. He was separated from CBS. But he did something that's very important and relates to what this last caller just said. There seems to be a misunderstanding about what free speech is. Free speech isn't the right to use Facebook's platform or the right to use Twitter's platform. Alex Jones absolutely can build any website or social media that he wants to build, and he can place it on the web, and he can say what he wants to say, and he can be indemnified through the Communications Decency Act. He can do all that. These are private corporations who can operate a terms of service that he happened to violate. Now, I mentioned that Alex Jones building his own network because that's exactly what Father Coughlin did. In 1933 and 34, he actually built the largest network of stations in the United States to have his sort of rantings about the Depression and the anti-Semitic stuff. Alex Jones today can do the same thing Father Coughlin did. He can build a website and a network for what he wants to say. You know, the issue then is a different one, which is how much control does Facebook have over the public sphere?
Mm-hmm.
But the question of free speech really doesn't apply here.
And also, he might have trouble getting internet companies to carry that show. I mean, you have to still use another company in order to get your show out there and on the air, right? Or he could, I suppose, he could build those structures himself.
Right. But from what I've seen, it's really it's actual Nazis that have had the ISP problem back with
right.
the Charlottesville protest, and there you get into the like Stormfront, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Stormfront, which is a Nazi webpage, has a big series of hosting problems and is now hosted outside the United States. They're actually inciting. They are yelling fire in a crowded theater. And so they are violating the law in a different way.
So we have a caller, Anthony, from Lake Delton. Welcome to the program, Anthony.
Thank you very much. And I just want to say thank you for reminding us about Father Coughlin. It seems to be a part of history that we don't want to educate a lot of people on. And that sort of dovetails into the other point I want to make. America seems to be abusing what is termed free speech. We need to keep in context the historical context of why we have the Bill of Rights. It was basically to allow Americans to repudiate the government. It wasn't so that we could beat up one another. Alex Jones is exploiting America's inability to think critically. That is what we should be talking about, how to examine what is being said around us. Alex Jones has found a platform which has very many loopholes, and he is exploiting that because of the same ignorance of critical thought processes. This dovetails, again, I use that word too much, I'm sorry, into a lot of the ails of quote-unquote free speech in America. Birtherism, conspiracies, 9/11, conspiracies, et cetera, alia. Free speech is a red herring. It's basically saying, oh, you can't prosecute me because I'm exercising a First Amendment right to say the stupidest things I can think of.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Peter from Madison has a similar comment. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's interesting that you hear so often that, you know, everything that someone says is protected under the First Amendment or free speech. But in reality, the First Amendment isn't designed to protect people from incendiary comments that are made to mobilize people to do their bidding or commit acts of violence or anything of the sort. So it is a little bit like it seems to be like a catch-all. If people don't agree with you, it's freedom of speech.
Thank you very much, Peter. Michael Sokolow, talk to me about that limit of free speech. You've looked at conspiracy theorists in the past, and have they come up to that limit also, and has it stopped them?
Well, interestingly, no. Like in the Father Coughlin case, it was stopped by a private corporation, just like Alex Jones. It was stopped by CBS. But both callers raise a really interesting theory, which we discuss in, you know, academically, which is called the rights and responsibilities theory, which is that, you know, the rights are actually given with an inherent understanding of responsibility, and everybody has forgotten the second part of responsibility. And the second part of what the caller had mentioned that's related to the rights and responsibility theory is we're talking all about the media right now, but really it's the education system. Now, I don't, you know, this is a complicated question, and I'm not going to get into it. The caller actually got into it quite well. But really, we should be teaching media criticism and media literacy in K through 12.
Yes.
And then the whole question of Alex Jones wouldn't be nearly as important as it seems to be.
You mentioned one of the recent past conspiracy theorists in your piece. You mentioned Glenn Beck. Talk to me about what Glenn Beck did.
Well, do you remember Glenn Beck's chalkboards on CNN?
Yes.
Where he would draw like a series of arrows connecting George Soros to the Democratic Party to all kinds of things. I don't even remember off the top of my head, but I remember the chalkboard. You know, he had, as I say in my piece, conspiracy theorists always have great details. They have, and most of them are factual, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's these odd linkages, and it's these assumptions, and it's these inferences that they then draw into the larger context that gets where they sort of spin out of control. And, you know, Glenn Beck, I listen to Glenn Beck's show every now and then, and Glenn Beck talks about media history, and he talks about political history in a quite sophisticated way. But then the larger inferences and context, and by the way, he's not anywhere near where he was 10 years ago on TV that made him very big, talking about these Obama conspiracies. And that's another thing. People sort of forget now his current radio show, The Blaze, and things like that are not at nearly as conspiracy-minded.
No,
he
seems to have come around. We have time for one more phone call. Colton from Rice, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and thanks so much for doing this program. I just wanted to say that I used to follow Alex Jones and InfoWars on YouTube. That was back before I went to college, and I want to say I really agree with one of your previous callers, who said that Alex Jones and other conspiracy theorists are kind of exploiting people's inability to think critically. And after I went to college and kind of learned to think critically, spot fake news and stuff like that, I really realized that what I was following on YouTube and listening to Alex Jones was a lot of falsehoods, and learning to question my own beliefs. I no longer follow him or believe in some of those extreme conspiracy theories, and I think part of that is due to education and learning to kind of question beliefs, think critically, and
thank
stuff
you.
Like that.
Thank you very much, Colton, for that. We're going to end there. Michael Sokolow is an associate professor of communication and journalism at the University of Maine. He wrote an article in The Conversation called Audiences Love the Anger, Alex Jones or Someone Like Him Will Be Back. Thanks, Michael, for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you, Colton, for showing us the value of a good critical thinking education. I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.